If I'd been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
This is Dr. Rob Stahl bringing you the only local call-in radio program exclusively for older adults and caregivers. What should you expect at your age? The answer is a lot, and that's what we're here to explain. I'm happy to have with me today physician Dr. Evan Calkins, an internist, rheumatologist, and geriatrician. The man introduced me to and fostered me through my geriatric training. Also with me is Mrs. Beverly Kubala, an RN registered nurse who currently serves as president of the Network in Aging of Western New York. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Here we go. The topic for today is the past, present, and future of geriatric care. In an American Geriatric Society publication entitled Why Geriatrics as a Career Choice, I found the following quotation. Having played roles as a general physician, rheumatologist, and academic administrator, I find that the practice of geriatrics and the varied issues that surround this practice is the most challenging and rewarding aspect of my medical career. Dr. Calkins, let me ask you, who spoke those words or who wrote those words? And please tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became who I and many others consider to be the father of geriatric medicine in Western New York.
I was startled to read that quote and then even more startled to discover that I was the person that had said it. but when I became interested in switching my career into the field of geriatrics, there already was a physician here that had made a commitment to geriatrics, because he really was the father of geriatrics in Buffalo, and I came along afterwards. A friend of mine named Alan Dixon, who had been a visiting professor in Buffalo, and I have known since I was working in Boston, and he was also with me at that point. He said that he was the number two man in his class at Cambridge Medical School, but the top man had gone into the field of geriatrics and set up a program in Hastings, England, and that if I was interested in seeing what geriatrics was like, I should go and visit him, which I did. And I began to see the possibilities of focusing programs and focusing interest and attention for what is required for older people, how different it is from the classic modes of practice, and a field that I thought was going to come on like gangbusters here in this country with the increasing population of older people. And so we did start a division of geriatrics, and it was the seventh such division in America to get started. And as you know yourself, because you were one of our first fellows, we had quite a good time and I think made some good strides in the field.
It was a tremendous effort on your part and foresight to see what was coming and what needed to be done. It certainly got me back on the right track, and I certainly don't regret.
Well, you've done a wonderful job, and you've pioneered many avenues of geriatrics, and we're proud of that.
Well, I'm going to keep on trying. Now, let's get to Bev. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
You know, first I'd like to say that I'm honored to be here with Dr. Calkins, because certainly as the current president of the Network in Aging, Dr. Calkins is always someone who inspires all of us. For my personal journey, you know, I really started out primarily in nursing. My background is nursing. I did the general acute care kind of thing, but then really took a sidestep over to alcoholism and drug dependency. And then I moved to home care, where I spent 15 years of my career. Now in my career, where I am a geriatric care manager within the law firm of Pfalzgraf Beinhauer Menzies.
And we were talking before about a health fair that I helped conduct at a senior apartment building. And one of the questionnaires, there was a question, what helps keep you going? And one of the items to check off was faith. And about 40% of the people checked off that their faith helps keep them going. And whether they had the resources to fully express their faith and utilize their faith, I think it was very doubtful.
You know, in my recent walk in care management, I've seen exactly the same thing, Dr. Stahl, where spirituality really keeps families going. And I've seen couples, senior couples, where one caregiver is doing what I would see as, from a nursing perspective, a huge job. They're just doing a monumental task of caring for their life partner towards the end of their life and doing things that I would perceive as almost impossible for them to do. But they do it in part certainly because they love the person, but because their faith really sustains them through these trials and tribulations that they're going through together.
It does have a tremendous impact. And to combine that with good medical knowledge, good information about resources available in the community, that's a dynamite combination. Now, I did a little research to find out how long the changes of aging have been documented in medical texts and literature. I went as far back as a text by Cicero, and this was 44 BCE. This was the year after Julius Caesar was assassinated.
You could read it in the original Latin, couldn't you?
I was working my way through it. I was a little slow, but they took Latin out of the medical school curriculum for some reason. Otherwise, I'd be golden. But what I found was Cicero's book. Shakespeare, in As You Like It, has the very famous passages, The Seven Ages of Man. That was written in 1598 or so. Now, I don't know if Dr. Calkins, you have any perspective on the history of geriatrics?
The crux comes when universities will develop academic, research, educational training programs in the field of geriatrics. That although my own perspective relates more to the medical side, all of the health science schools and all of the disciplines have major challenges in the field of aging, not only the social disciplines, but dentistry has a very important role and an active role. And in our programs, we combined our fellowship training with our for our physicians with also a fellowship training program for dentists.
Mm-hmm.
So that all the health science fields, as well as the social support networks, are involved.
And beyond that, too, architecture. I believe
yes.
Your niece
yes.
wrote a book on variable architecture that would allow an older person to stay living where they were but have the architecture change around them rather than them move to a new place of living.
And that's a very critical piece because oftentimes, especially if it's an older home, the bathrooms are very small and narrow. Now, all of a sudden, when you have a member of the household who requires a walker or a wheelchair, you need to look at actually structurally changing so that they can gain access.
What area do you see that hasn't been developed enough that should be brought into this?
Medicine needs to get off its high hat a little bit and get to feeling a little bit more commonality with the human race and these students that need to realize that they're just part of a range of people that are all contributing to making patients better.
One thing that disturbed me that I read recently is the cutback in funding to adult care facilities. And what this has caused is adult care facilities, adult homes, an intermediate level of care. Someone who can't quite manage that in their own home but isn't ready for a nursing home. It's forced many of these adult care facilities to close. So where do these people go? They end up going to nursing homes because they can't go back home.
Many nursing homes are getting into trouble now because they can't afford to provide the care that they're required to provide under the regulations because the reimbursement rate is so low. So, it really is this vicious cycle of issues and concerns that on the one hand, the government doesn't want to raise the SSI rate. Then you've got, the trickle-down effect of causing a greater burden on basically taxpayers or the Medicaid system because they're forced to be put into a nursing home.
Over the past couple of years, I've conceptualized something I coined grassroots geriatrics, and we were talking about that beforehand. And it involves patients, caregivers, taking back some of the responsibility. And it's not that people aren't working very hard out there to stay in their own places, that families aren't helping people and struggling along and being frustrated. And in some cases, families and lives being torn apart by the difficulties in doing it. But I feel we need to offer tools to empower people at the grassroots level. And I have on the Grassroots Geriatrics website that I put together, grassrootsgeriatrics.org, I take off from President Kennedy's inaugural speech. And I state, ask not what your doctor can do for you, ask what you can do for your doctor. And this is taking self-assessment tools, and I'm trying to promote that for older people. We need a larger force to promote it and encourage it and make sure that people get it and fill it out and bring it to their doctor. This would provide a profile for a doctor who knows little about geriatrics, could now take a look at this packet of information that deals specifically with key geriatric issues. It helps to educate the patient and family that these aren't dead ends, that their incontinence is not a plague of aging, that there's nothing that can be done about, that depression is to be expected because you're old and what do you have to expect at your age? Things like this, or that they're not able to function in certain areas, and that's also part of aging, that you just have to struggle along. No, there's help out there to be had. And this is very inexpensive, grassroots. You involve people who would be more than willing to put the effort into such things. That's a direction I would like to see developed. I think it has benefit in that everyone gets involved. It educates. It ultimately provides better care. And it's very inexpensive. Any comments about low-cost intervention?
I know that several very cutting-edge geriatricians are concerned about this, interested in this, and the question of educational programs for care providers is really attracted their interest, and they have developed some very excellent programs to really help the care provider.
We do have some programs here locally. The Erie County Department of Senior Services and the Niagara Caregiver Coalition has put together some caregiver education, powerful tools for caregivers. And it's a 7-part series where it really helps the caregiver to learn how to access services, but also how to manage their own stress. If we were to lose these informal caregivers, it would cost billions of dollars to our healthcare system.
How is that provided? Is it in written form or is it on the internet? Or?
It's actually a classroom. It's hosted at different sites around Erie County. But it is something that, not directly through the network, but through certainly the coalition of providers through the Network in Aging and the Niagara Caregivers Network, these have been developed and are being provided. And certainly in my role as a care manager, I think that's the critical thing that I do, is really go in and help families to understand what there is available to them, how to access it, and sometimes even walking with them hand in hand so that they can get to the right doctor. Because I can't tell you how many times I've been frustrated when someone that I know will go to their family physician that they've gone to for years with concerns about a memory impairment, and they're told that, well, it's just aging. And it's not always just aging. You know, that really is something that needs to be looked at and looked at well. And that's a great disservice to both the patient and the family to not have that explored.
I think the dynamics is going to change somewhat over the coming years as the baby boomers are the ones in this aging group more comfortable with technology and seeking out information, not satisfied with the status quo. And there'll be pressure from that end to force that a lot of these issues get dealt with.
The problem is that the primary care physicians back against the wall, most of them have got a real struggle to keep the economics of their practice mm-hmm. going. Mm-hmm. They have to cut down their time with patients to 10 or 15 minutes or something, mm-hmm. whereas it takes a good hour to make any real progress, even for second or third visits with mm-hmm. issues of this sort. And they throw up their hands. They just don't know what in the heaven's name to do.
And I think if we had the billions of dollars that the drug companies have mm-hmm. to promote the medications on the television, that patients promptly take that information, go to the doctor and say, what about this? They say this is going to cure me, that this is the better than what you're giving me. If we had the billions to say, this is the assessment that you have to do for yourself, bring it to your doctor, and demand that your doctor does something about it. That's the parallel that, mm-hmm. that I see that needs to happen. And how can we work together with all of our great interest and dedication, not a for-profit motive, clearly,
right.
but a for-health motive, just trying to make things a little better for older people. Mm-hmm. In the last few minutes, I just want to touch on the future. And there's anti-aging medicine movements out there. There was recently an article in Technology Review, Can We Live Together? This is MIT's monthly magazine. And there was an article written by Sherwin Nuland, a very well-regarded physician who's written some fantastic books. He interviewed a man who believes within 20, 25 years, with concerted effort, that we can develop the science to stop aging. I want to know, when can I hang up my hat as a geriatrician and start studying how to be an eternatrician? Any comments on that?
But I'm not sure that we were meant to be here forever.
Well, so, you get into the philosophical and spiritual answers or discussion about those questions. You know, let's face it, I think to myself, 100 years from now, doctors are going to be saying, that Dr. Stahl and all the docs back then, they had to deal with Alzheimer's disease. They had to deal with cancer. They had to deal with diabetes. What are the docs 100 years from now going to be dealing with? Is the anti-aging remedies that are being proposed? A lot of it is advertising, not based in science, and people out to make a buck, clearly, on this population that's maybe afraid of dying, afraid of getting older.
I think that's certainly central to the American culture, where we really deny aging, you know, whether we don't want to believe that we're going to get older, but it's certainly something that I think we all need to come to terms with at some level or another.
Well, we're going to have to stop there. We'll leave that for the audience to answer. And thanks so much to Dr. Calkins and Mrs. Kubala for being with me today. This is Dr. Rob Stahl. See you then.